First case on our calendar is 97-268, State of Ohio versus Harry D. Mitz, Jr. Mr. Parker.
May it please the court, good morning. I am John Parker. I do represent the public. Mr. Mitz, along with the co-counsel, Dave Dowd. I would request that. Thank you. On behalf of Mr. Mitz, I'd like to address two issues. First, third issue is briefing. And just a brief recitation of the facts is necessary to get going here. The appellant shot and killed a civilian, a police officer, and wounded two other police officers in August of 1984. He was convicted of numerous counts of aggravated murder, with two of the counts containing possible death penalty. Before the mitigation phase of the case began, trial counsel requested a jury instruction stating that the jury should be allowed to consider consecutive life sentences when it was making its recommendation to the trial judge. That request was denied by the trial court. And coincidentally, during the deliberations, the jury posed a question to the trial court. In particular, that question was, would a verdict of life on count one and count two be served consecutively or concurrent? The trial court basically answered that question by saying that was not the jury's concern. And then, sometime thereafter, the jury came back with the death verdict on count one and count two. It's the appellant's position that the denial of this requested jury instruction violated his right to due process under the 14th Amendment and also cruel and unusual punishment under the 8th Amendment. And the appellant relies upon the relatively recent case of Simmons versus South Carolina from the U.S. Supreme Court, a 7-2 decision in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that the jury in South Carolina in this particular case should have been informed that the appellant was looking at either death or life without parole. And I think there are two fundamental principles that this court needs to look at when considering this issue that is explained in Simmons. The first issue, which the court first explained in Gardner versus Florida, is that a due process clause does not allow someone to be executed on the basis of information which he had no opportunity to deny or explain. And I think the explanation is a key word in this. And the general principle that Simmons relied upon is that the state cannot secure a death sentence while at the same time concealing from the sentencing jury the true meaning of the non-capital sentencing alternative. And that's what we have in this particular case, is that the jury, even the trial counsel requested this instruction, the jury asked for the same instruction, basically, during deliberations. The trial court did not allow the sentencing jury to know what the non-capital sentencing alternative was. And yet, obviously, the facts are very important here. Here you have one dead police officer, a dead civilian, and two wounded police officers. And there is no way that this trial court, or any other trial court, I would suggest, was seriously contemplating concurrent life sentences, given the scenario, if that's what the jury recommended. And at this time, the death penalty statute carried a possible 20 or 30 full years to life. It's very possible that the jury could have recommended to the trial court judge a sentence of either 20 plus 20 for 40 to life, 20 plus 30 for 50 to life, or 30 plus 30 for 60 to life. And given the appellant's age, he's in his late 30s at the time, the jury may have believed that the maximum life sentence of 60 to life would be an appropriate punishment in this case, given the fact that there was significant mitigation. And the fact that a man was sentenced to death when there were non-capital sentencing alternatives not only available, but that alternative was requested by counsel, which the court denied, and then the jury that exact instruction, and then once again was denied that opportunity, that is a violation of the process. And that's what we are relying on. And it's very similar to Skipper, South Carolina versus Skipper and the Gardner case, where the defendant was prevented from rebutting information that the sentencing authority considered and relied upon and imposing them. And here we have a jury relying upon the court's instruction quite clearly that that was not their concern, and they immediately come back and say,
well, is it their concern?
It is, because...
Are they allowed to impose consecutive or concurrent the jury?
Your Honor, I know you wrote the opinion in State versus Grant, which you may be referring to, which said that it was not their decision to recommend concurrent or consecutive sentences. And I respectfully argue to you, Your Honor, that first of all, Grant was decided before Simmons versus South Carolina. And Grant does not address this due process issue. And I think that this court, in light of Simmons versus South Carolina, needs to reconsider its position in Grant.
Does Simmons allow the jury to make that determination?
In Simmons, the options were a little bit simpler in that it was either death or life without parole. But here we have a similar thing where...
So what was it that wasn't explained in Simmons?
In that particular case of Simmons, the prosecution argued that he might be dangerous in the future, his future dangerous. And the Simmons lawyer wanted to argue, look, he's not ever going to get out if you give him life without parole. And the defense was prevented from making that argument. And the Supreme Court held, look, once the state says that he might be dangerous in the future, they're entitled to know that he's never going to get out if they go with something less than death. We have a very similar situation here, Your Honor, where the appellant was in his late 30s, and it's a somewhat rare situation where the jury had the opportunity to choose consecutive sentences if it wanted to. As I explained, it could be up to 60 to life, and given his age, that would in effect be a life without parole sentence.
How would you have the judge respond?
I would have the judge respond that, yes, you may recommend that the sentences be consecutive or concurrent, 20 or 30, so the jury could recommend.
Okay, what's the legal effect of that? It's not provided for me.
This is a constitutional issue. It's not in our statute. I grant you that. But this is a constitutional issue where...
So the jury's recommendation has no legal import.
Oh, of course it does, Your Honor. If they come back with a recommendation of life without...
No, but their recommendation as to concurrent or consecutive.
Well, if the judge wants to ignore that, maybe he can. But the point is, they're deciding...
Well, maybe he can. He has an absolute right to.
Well, but it would still be a life sentence versus a death sentence. And that's the difference here. Here, the jury is choosing between death and life. And that's
What was the specific question from the jury?
The specific question was, would a verdict of life on count one and count two be served consecutively or concurrently?
And the answer?
And the answer was, not your concern. But it is their concern when they're choosing a sentence that would be less than death. And I would point this court's attention to the concurrence in sentence.
So a better answer would be, that's my call, not yours.
What?
That's what he said.
The better answer would be, you may recommend consecutive sentences. See, the point is, Your Honor...
But isn't that essentially misleading the jury?
I mean, no.
Wouldn't better answer, if you want that answer, you may recommend, but I can ignore.
Well, Your Honor, we're talking about the difference.
And then you're, it seems to me, then you're right back in the same suit. If the jury knows the judge doesn't have to follow it, then the jury may say, well...
We know that the judge has to follow a life sentence. If the jury comes back to life sentence, the judge has to follow that. And when a jury's concern is the possibility of parole, which is obviously their concern, given the nature of the question and given the options they had, it was their concern whether he was going to get out. Then a person who's going to be sentenced to death certainly should have the option of the jury saying, we don't want you to die, but we don't want you to hurry it out. And the way you put that into effect is through consecutive sentencing, if that's what the jury wants to. I mean, if you look at the concurrence and sentence, it's under the Eighth Amendment, but it's very instructive because, as the court said there, when you withhold from the jury the less than death sentence, the trial court diminishes the reliability of the jury's decision on death. That death is a more appropriate remedy to the person. And that's what we're talking about. And this is not a question of guilt or innocence here. It's a question about punishment. And death being the most severe, it's treated differently. And when someone is sentenced to death, they are given extra protection for the jury's recommendation. And what's wrong with the jury saying, because they really think the judge is going to give the sentences here? I mean, that's just not a practical reality. And the jury was misled when the judge implied that he might give the concurrent sentence. And then that resulted in the concurrent sentence. I mean, it's just not realistic at all to think that in this particular situation, the trial court judge is going to impose concurrent sentences. And the judge could apply to the jury by answering the question. And the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has always held that relevant sentencing and mitigation information that is concealed from the jury is the basis for the reversal of the sentence. And that's basically what we have here. We're concealing information from the jury. And I don't think this court would say that a practice in our trial court where we're concealing relevant information when they're deciding to do life. With respect to the third issue, it concerns the merger of the death penalty specification. The 8th District Court of Appeals held that it was hard that the specification should have been merged for purposes of the mitigation hearing, but it was harmless error beyond reasonable doubt. The 8th District, though, fails to acknowledge that the state, in its argument during the mitigation phase, argued about the number of specifications. And here, on count one, we have two aggravating factors, that being the so-called mass murder specification, the police officer specification. And on count two, you only have the one aggravating factor, that being the mass murder. And the state got up and argued in their mitigation argument that concerning the number of aggravators, the aggravating factor, they got up there and argued about the number, and that was clearly improper. And here you have a case where there is mitigation. And I know that this court has held that the independent review of the appellate court and this court somehow cures this situation. However, with all due respect to this court, it seems to be an automatic harmless error standard. And in this particular case, we're asking you to set forth that it is not an automatic harmless error when there is mitigation in this case. Mitigation in this case is that my client was in his late 30s, no criminal record, he was remorseful, he had a job, he was intoxicated, military service. Well, the facts of the case are bad, as they always are in these cases. There is significant mitigation here. And when the jury asked the question they asked, and as I related in my first argument, they were definitely considering a life sentence here. And when you consider the state's argument concerning the number of aggravating factors here, coupled with the number of factors that the state argued, it's improper to say that this is harmless error in this particular case.
How can you say they were considering that as a penalty? It could be one person had a question in a form and just said, well, let's get an answer to that for you. You can't blanketly say that they were considering that sentence just because the question was given.
Your Honor, as you're well aware, it only takes one person to save his life.
I understand.
And if that person wanted or was considering consecutive sentences for life, then no death sentence could be imposed. So I think by the fact that they could not resolve...
All I'm saying is you make a blanket statement, and I don't think that's fair to say that.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's no question. You were a trial judge for many years. You know how to read that question, Your Honor. And they always try to resolve those questions amongst themselves. They're instructed to do that. And when they do ask a question, it's obviously something that's very important to at least one person. And in this situation, one person will save my client's life, but they don't think that is the appropriate sentence. Or if they think that the aggravating factors don't outweigh the mitigating circumstances beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you combine all of these things that I've argued, I don't think I'm making a reach, Your Honor, when I'm saying that at least one juror was considering a life sentence.
And going along with Justice Pfeiffer's question, I think that you're misleading the jury when you say, well, the court has the prerogative to make it consecutive or concurrent, and then they go along with that, and the court disappoints them in what they felt the court was going to do. Aren't you misleading the jury in even telling them that that's a possibility into reaching a verdict which they may not have reached had they not been told that?
Your Honor, I think you're misleading the jury when you suggest that concurrent sentences are going to be a realistic possibility in a case such as this, because as the court eventually imposed consecutive sentences on every count, and when you have a dead police officer, a dead civilian, and two wounded police officers, I don't think there's any realistic chance in any trial court to impose concurrent sentences in that situation. And I think you're misleading the jury when you suggest to them or instruct them that you may impose concurrent sentences. In fact, you can look to the judge's opinion that he's mandated to give. And the opinion he said that there was no mitigation. And that's clearly incorrect. And if that's the trial court's view, that there was no mitigation presented, you know So, Your Honor, with all due respect, I have to disagree with you on that. And I think that if you look at everything, you're misleading the jury by implying that there's going to be concurrent sentences.
Okay, in the abstract, this court this is an instruction on what? On the state of the law.
Absolutely.
Right, and the state of the law is that this is a decision for the court. And to say that, I guess it seems to me that it's equally speculative for you to say that the statement by the court that this is not your concern equates with the statement that I might give a concurrent sentence.
Your Honor, there's no question that it's the jury's concern whether it's death or life.
But the question didn't say death or life. The question said concurrent or consecutive.
But that means that they're considering a life sentence in this particular case. And I think that the jury...
See, you're throwing a lot into that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you have to be practical when you look at these cases. And when you have two counts, all right, that makes it different than where you have just one count, whether they're considering death or life. And here you have two counts where they're considering death or life.
But all that being true, but still, the court was asked a question and had to answer according to Ohio law.
Well, I had to answer according to the Constitution of the United States, Your Honor. And that is Simmons versus South Carolina.
But Simmons is a different case.
Well, it's different concerning the future dangerousness. I grant you that. Right. That was not argued by the state of this.
And that was and it seems to me that was really, if there's any holding there, it was the future dangerousness that prompted the court to say this was the defense was entitled to refute.
That's the factual holding of Simmons. That's a very narrow holding. There's no question about that, Your Honor. But if you also look at the first paragraph of the actual opinion, not the factual part, the legal opinion, it says the state cannot secure a death sentence while at the same time concealing from the sentencing jury the true meaning of non-capital sentencing alternatives. And the true meaning of non-capital sentencing alternatives in this state, in this situation, include the possibility of consecutive life sentences. And the jury was absolutely, they were not given that alternative. That was concealed from them.
They weren't told anything about consecutive or concurrent, were they?
They were told it wasn't their problem.
I understand. So were the words consecutive or concurrent used at all?
By the jury itself. And
I
knew
that.
Yeah. In its question. The jury asked, will they be consecutive or concurrent? They should at the very, they should have been told that because
it could be either or. Yes, the court made sentence either or.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, and
they were left with the impression that what you say doesn't matter. And of course it does. I mean, I can't imagine a case, especially this one, where a jury, if they were given an opportunity to choose consecutive sentences, consecutive life sentences, I can't imagine a trial court judge going to say, not under these facts.
Well, we don't deal in imagining, you know, we just don't.
I understand, Your Honor, but we're talking about man's life here. Let's stop. And when the jury is considering death or life, they are allowed to consider all the alternatives. They simply were not given that opportunity. Even the counsel requested it, and the jury requested it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Zimmerman.
My name is David Zimmerman. I represent the state of Ohio. Through the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, I represent the appellate. Dealing first with the issue.
Mr. Zimmerman, shouldn't the jury have been given a different answer here?
No, I don't believe so, because the judge instructed the jury specifically as an opinion from this court, this Supreme Court has been, that it's not within the province for the jury to consider concurrent or consecutive sentences. That's not for them to consider.
It's not their job.
It's not within their province to even consider. And so the court gave the instruction, and this court has stated through its opinion, that it's not within the province of the jury to consider concurrent or consecutive decisions. So I feel that the court's response to the jury question was appropriate. And in fact, the speculation that Appellant wants to raise was addressed by Justice Douglas in State v. Allard, when a similar question was asked, and Justice Douglas stated the first appellant's assertion regarding the jury's motive for asking about consecutive and concurrent sentences are purely speculative. They're only speculations. The issues that appellant is raising of what the jury was considering or what the jury might have done is all speculation, and no weight can be given to that speculation.
Does Simmons still bear on the
Simmons subject? Has no bearing on this case. Simmons dealt with the issue specifically. In Simmons, there were two sentences possible. One was life imprisonment, one was a death penalty. Because of the sentencing provision in California, in South Carolina, then, Simmons would not have been eligible for parole at all because he had several prior violent offenses. When the jury got the case, they issued a question, what is the meaning of life sentence? And trial counsel for Simmons wanted the jury instructed that in this case, by law, a life sentence is a true life sentence, and the defendant would never get parole. That was denied by the court. Instead, the court gave a definition along the facts of use your common knowledge of what the definition of life means.
But Simmons, I mean, like Ohio, that was still outside the practice of the jury, wasn't it? I mean, that
no,
business about whether he was eligible for parole really wasn't their province, so to speak.
No, because the jury question wasn't whether the defendant was going to get or not get, or what parole was. Their question is, what's the definition of a life sentence? They want to know, does life sentence mean a life sentence? Never having a chance for parole.
But that, what's their consideration in asking that question?
For the defendant to get out.
Parole.
But that became a consideration because the state of South Carolina argued in their case future dangerousness. That was never argued in this case. We never argued future dangerousness. The opinion in Simmons specifically was under the 14th Amendment due process consideration. And the due process clause does not allow the execution of a person on the basis of information they had no opportunity to deny or explain. In this case, they wanted to explain what life was and that the defendant would never have a chance to get parole, and that was to deny or explain that future dangerousness. That's actually where the opinion came down in the due process analysis, was the inability, if you look at the concurring opinion by Justice Stephen O'Connor and Rehnquist, they joined in the judgment that was written by Blackmun and was joined by Ginsburg, Souter, and Stevens. And in that opinion, in the main opinion, there were five different opinions written in that case. if you will, with Stevens, they would have said that under the Eighth Amendment, coronary rule punishment, that's the standard we apply. The remaining majority applied the 14th Amendment analysis, and it was the defendant's opportunity to deny or explain a specific issue. And that denial or explanation was explaining that future dangerousness was not an issue in this case because the defendant would never be released on parole. And that's the 14th Amendment due process issue that arose here. Most of the cases cited by defendant that the U.S. Supreme Court has found where the jury has to be able to consider certain mitigating evidence has been Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment. This is not an Eighth Amendment case. This is not a case. Simmons is not an Eighth Amendment case. Simmons is not a case that says the states have to allow a jury to consider consecutive or concurrent, or what the appellant wants to do is make this life sentence, a real life sentence, for the jury to consider. Under the statute, under 2929.03d2, there are only three sentences that a jury can consider by statute, by law. And the court instructed them on the jury on those three sentences. Appellant can now not make a fourth sentence, this quote-unquote life versus death sentence, for a jury to consider. That is now a consideration under the new law in the state of Ohio. But at that time, the law of Ohio was only life imprisonment, or was a sentence of death, life imprisonment with parole consideration after 20 years, and life imprisonment with parole considerations after 30 years. So the court in this case acted completely properly in the instructions they gave to the jury of what they could consider, and then in the instructions when their question came out, was that that is not within your province, you're not to even consider consecutive or concurrent sentence.
But since the jury has that obligation, and the court gets a question on that very subject that they refused to charge on, don't you think it's better to let the jury know what the possibilities are than let them wander around? I mean, here's, counsel raised a good point. He only needs one person. And say it's only one person that has a question on this, that's saying, well, you know, I could go along, I want to go along with life if I thought he'd never get out. I think my life is more appealing to me because I think it's more justified. Why don't you ask him this? It will really help me determine that question. Ask the court if it's concurrent or consecutive, and if it's consecutive life sentences, I think I could really go for that better. Where are you infringing upon the court's discretion if the court came back and said, listen, consecutive or concurrent is not in the province of the jury, that is in the province of the trial court, and the trial court will exercise that prerogative. What's wrong with that?
Because they knew, I would say there's no error in a court instructing the jury along that line. But then what could occur is you could have a juror, now the appellant wants to argue, well, in this case, the judge would only have given consecutive sentences because of the nature of the facts.
Well, the jury,
but if you come up with a rule like that, in any other case, a juror could say, well, the judge is going to give them consecutive sentences, so yeah, I'll go with life. But that doesn't mean the judge will. Why should we give the jury something to consider, which is purely speculation?
Isn't the court in these instructions required to follow the law, and we want consistency when one person charged with a capital offense goes to trial in one part of the state and in another part, that the court is consistent.
Right.
And rather than leaving these kinds of things up to the discretion, if this were what Justice Sweeney is mentioning, we could have different instructions all over the state. Isn't the court required to follow the law? And at this time, the law was, we had two choices, life with parole and 20 years later, three choices, parole and 30 years, and the death penalty. The court was following the law, wasn't he?
And that is the law. The law is that this is not the province of the jury to consider consecutive or concurrent sentences. I think the instruction is the appropriate instruction. That is not, I mean, I don't think it would be error if you would have gone further, but I think the proper instruction is, it's not this province to enter into determination whether this, or decision whether these will be concurrent or consecutive. That's not for your consideration. That would only be speculation on the jury if they would bring that into their deliberation. We don't want the jury speculating when they're deliberating a person's life or death. We want them to consider the facts and what is within their province. And within their province is not concurrent or consecutive sentences.
Counsel, I'm interested in a different issue. This defendant was charged under A, was it not? Purposely...
Correct. Prior calculation is on. Okay. For both counts.
For both counts. What is the prior calculation? What is the evidence of prior calculation and design with respect to the first...
So the first, in relation to John Ryan? Yeah, John Ryan. With John Ryan, he was inside his apartment. He armed himself. Took the gun, walked
out. Well, he'd been armed pretty much all day.
He's always armed.
And,
he has,
all
he
of his life.
Yeah. He specifically armed himself with the scope, 22 caliber pistol.
Okay, but that being armed was not uncommon for this gentleman.
No, I would disagree with that because we're dealing with the mitigation evidence because...
From what I read, that sounded like an everyday practice.
He would go to the range and shoot often, right. And he had guns in his apartment. He had two different guns and thousands of rounds in his apartment. But he armed himself before going outside.
All right.
And he sees Tracy Griffin and the victim in this case, Mr. Bryant, walking up towards the apartment. He takes that gun. As he walks out the hallway, he runs into the first person, Timothy Roan, and he tells Roan to get out of there, he's going to kill him. He's already made a decision of who he's going to kill.
He's going to kill who?
He's going to kill Timothy Roan. He points the gun at Timothy Roan's head and says, get out or I'll kill you.
All right.
We're in the basically lobby of the apartment. Timothy Roan at first thought he was joking, and the defendant repeated what he had said. Timothy Roan then runs out. He walks out to where the defendant, to where the victim and Tracy Griffin are walking along, and he says his statement, which demonstrates his intent, is niggers, 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 I'm tired of niggers. He puts that laser red dot right on the defendant's chest and fires once, killing him.
Okay.
When the prior calculation is shown by his arming himself, making a decision, he wasn't going out there to kill Timothy Roan, he was going out to kill a black man that was walking with a white woman.
We have our own debate here as to how much... What constitutes prior calculation design? And let me read to you just the first paragraph. Let me read you two paragraphs. The committee notes for the death penalty. The first... opening up to the chapter. This chapter contains a single capital offense defined in the code as aggravated murder, which includes the planned killing in cold blood and the purposeful killing committed during kidnapping, etc., etc. And then right after 29-2301, the committee notes, the first part of this section restates the former crime of premeditated murder so as to embody the classic concept of the planned cold-blooded killing while discarding the notion that only an instant's prior deliberation is necessary, period.
Right. This is an occasion where he was outside and they happen to come upon each other and he pulls a gun and shoots him. This is an incident where he's inside his apartment, walks out, arms himself to walk out, makes a determination, personally sees Timothy Rome. He's not going out there to kill Timothy Rome. He knows who he's going out there to kill. And he walks out of the apartment and approaches Griffin and the victim, Brian.
They're coming back from the grocery store. How does he even know they're out there in the street?
He had an apartment that faces the front with a sliding glass window in the front that faces, it's not a street, it's actually part of the driveway that goes to this whole apartment complex. So he has a view of the whole front of the apartment.
And that's the evidence of prior calculation and design?
Yes, it is. That this was a commentary.
He has a window that he can see the street, and he puts a gun in the back of his
pants. No, he walks out with a folding the gun.
Okay, and the first person he confronts, he says, I'm going to kill you.
Get out or I'll kill you. He's not going out there to kill Timothy Rome. That was not his purpose, his prior government. His intent was going out to kill Mr. Bryant.
Was there some evidence of that? Any statement that he made or made to others?
That he made, the statement he made when then he approached Bryant and Griffin, the racial comment?
No, I mean, after he's arrested, did he?
He never made a statement.
And he never, you had no testimony from others who said that I thought I read that he actually got along with his neighbors.
What came out in the mitigation.
Until this incident, there was no indication of any animus at all toward
No, there wasn't.
These people. Okay.
But there's more than an instantaneous decision here. I mean, he put on a pair of shooting earmuffs that he put on over his head, and he took the gun. I mean, it wasn't in his back or concealed somewhere like he was going to take it. He went out there armed with the intention of shooting. And the first person he shot, if he was just going out because he snapped, as defense had argued in the case at the trial court level, then he would have shot the first person he saw, but he didn't. He went out there with the purpose of a specific person he was going to shoot, and that was Mr. Barnes.
Mr. Zimmerman, I have two matters. First is, to rule on the consecutive sentencing question that the appellant urges us to do, would we have to overrule State v. Allard, at least in part?
Yes, you'd have to overrule State v. Allard, you'd have to overrule State v. Grant, you'd have to overrule even your most recent opinion this year, State v. Smith.
Okay, so, because those were pretty clear, and while the circumstances could be are a little different in each of those cases, it's pretty clear that the issue is consecutive versus concurrent in questions from the jury.
In this case?
No, in all of those
cases. In all of those cases, correct.
Okay, so they'd have to be overruled, at least in part, in order to rule as they're suggesting.
Correct.
The second matter that concerns me is the mitigation. If the mitigation here is not strong enough to negate the sentence of death, when would it ever be? I mean, this is...
I have had cases where the mitigation was found sufficient to overrule the finding of death, and those were cases where you have one of the first specific statutory mitigating factors involved. We had none of the statutory mitigating factors involved in this case, where a victim partially caused what occurred, where there may be a mental illness factor such that, but the catch-all factors, which all the mitigating factors in this case that came under BSEP, the catch-all, what I term the catch-all section of the statute. All they showed is up to this point he was a nice guy.
Well, but you do have some of those mitigating factors in reverse. For instance, the age question doesn't come in, but certainly the one with regard to prior criminal record does.
Right.
Here's somebody
who
by all accounts has lived a pretty exemplary life for all these years and gets intoxicated and kills some people. Wrong. They ought to be punished. But the
I don't believe there was ever a showing that he was intoxicated when he committed his murder. I think the facts bear out that he wasn't intoxicated when he committed his murder.
Well, at least we can accept you've been drinking.
Well, I don't even accept, I don't think the evidence even demonstrated he was drinking beforehand. He was at the shooting range beforehand. The people who saw him at the shooting range said he did not drink anything there, and he was not intoxicated. The first evidence of law of him drinking is after both the murders and the first attempted murder, when he's talking to Lieutenant Kaiser, who's now negotiating with him,
he says,
I'm drinking.
I understand all that, and I understand what...
So I don't think any way to the conversation.
Where would we ever find a case where there is mitigation? What else could they have presented to negate the death penalty here? And I recognize the jury's going to do what it's in effect led to do. The question is a little bothersome to me because they were considering something else, or at least one person was. But what else could they have added for the trial judge to have said, no, I'm not accepting the recommendation and I'm going to impose life in prison?
In the murder of a police officer, in the murder of another person, and in the attempted murder of two people, I don't think there's any mitigation evidence that would have been.
That's what I wanted to get at. There is no mitigation in your mind under the circumstances of any of these cases that are this, and they're all bad.
Right.
So there is no mitigation.
No, I don't think there would have been anything sufficient that they could have presented overruled.
No, but I say you can't ever see it in any case.
No, not with this factual situation.
Well, this factual situation isn't much different than the other ones we see. Normally, it could be very well young children who are raped, and it's others who are mass murdered, or it is old people who are, you know, the facts are bad in all of them.
True.
What's your view with respect to the reverse of the person who is seems to be normal, has normal intelligence, and has a fairly normal life, as defendant apparently does here, except that he carried guns everywhere he went with him. But we've had more cases than this are cases in which the defendant oftentimes is a battered child, lives in a violent environment most of his life or her life as they're growing up, and now they're you know, like a bomb, and they go off and somebody gets murdered. Is that, as you know, we've had cases, and I've written in a couple where I thought that was mitigation. What's your view of, when you say there's no, when you say there's nothing that could be mitigating, you mean in this case, there was
this
nothing
case
that could have been presented here?
In this case, I don't think there was anything of Mr. Mitt's history or personality or anything about him that could have been entered into that would have overcome the aggravating circumstances.
It's interesting that before does seem to suggest that in looking at a person's prior record, that would be mitigation. But the statute doesn't seem to take into account those other factors that we see more likely, where there oftentimes is a record, or at least there is violent conduct that is produced by the environment in which the person has lived during most of their life.
I think that the more mitigation weight could be given to a person without the criminal history, but has the prior history of being raised in a violent family, of being abused, who this is a one-time violent response. The person who has a prior history of criminal behavior, this isn't a one-time happening thing. This isn't a one-time where he lost. This is a case where the person over the years has decided to engage in criminal activity, and leading up to the point where he actually engaged in criminal activity that resulted in the murder of a person.
In fact, you could make an argument that this person, unless that prior history suggests that they're subject to rehabilitation or could be rehabilitated and therefore not put to death. But you could argue that a person like this is a better candidate for the death penalty than someone who really hasn't had a chance in life because of the environment in which they've lived. They've known nothing except violence, and it's predictable that they're going to be violent. Not as an excuse, but it's predictable that they're going to be violent. Actually, it seems to me that you make a stronger argument for death in a case like this, where the person has a better ability, I guess, to not do what he's done here. You don't need to comment. This is an interesting area to me. That's why I'm exploring it with you.
I would say that the defendant in this case was what we would term a common joke. I mean, he was a normal person who did not go through the trauma that a lot of the defendants we see go through during their early childhood and as they're growing up. This person led a normal life. This actions of his made even that more horrendous what he did, because he knew how to act properly. He was raised properly, and he knew what he did was wrong. So yeah, I think it would weigh even more against the nature of what he did, especially if being involved with two separate people and then attempt to kill two other people besides him. Finally, is the issue that was raised as far as murder, I would note that the state never argued numbers in their argument. They may have argued the number of victims, and that there were two people killed and two people that were attempted to be killed in this case. And that is what weighed so heavily for the imposition of the death penalty, of the number of victims. We never argued number of aggravating circumstances. And as the Court of Appeals found, once you merge those three mass murder specifications into one mass murder specification, the evidence is the same that the jury would consider, that this aggravated murder was committed when the defendant purposely killed a second person and then attempted to purposely kill two other people. So the evidence the jury was considering, whether they were merged or not merged, was the same thing. And if any numbers were argued by the state, it was only the number of victims, not the number of aggravated circumstances. And there was no instruction to the jury that greater weight should be given because there are more numbers, more in the actual number of aggravated circumstances. If there's no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Mr. Parker, you saved 10 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to respond first by stating that the U.S. Supreme Court has made real clear that juries must be allowed to consider all relevant sentencing considerations. Now, in Ohio, our statute, you can see, does not allow specifically the imposition of consecutive life sentences. But the Constitution says all relevant sentencing considerations. That's how it's been interpreted. And if the jury is not allowed, especially when they ask for this, they ask the question they ask in this case, if they're not allowed to know this relevant sentencing consideration, then our statute is unconstitutional in that respect. And this court, while the trial court must follow the law, this court obviously makes some law and follows it too. The law at the time was Simmons versus South Carolina. And that all relevant sentencing considerations must be followed. They must be given to the jury. So that's something that this court needs to address. With respect to the mitigation, there was significant mitigation in this case. This is an unusual case in that there was a lot of mitigation, but a man had lived a mostly normal life until this drinking incident, which obviously led directly to the shootings and the deaths and the injuries in this case. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that is significant mitigation.
Is that because he is more likely to be rehabilitated because he has normal intelligence and he has shown that he knows how to live a relatively normal life? Is that why we look at that as mitigation rather than the reverse?
I think that is an important part of the mitigation, Your Honor. If you look at the statute, the aggravating circumstances in this case were very limited. And that the intoxication issue and the fact that he was intoxicated, it was in the detective's police report that's contained in the record he testified about. The detective put in his police report, he was slurring his words, it was intoxicated.
Well, as you know, this court hasn't looked very kindly on defendants who come in saying, well, I was intoxicated, so I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, intoxication is a willful act. I mean, regardless of all the other theories, I mean, and so forth, why someone is intoxicated, but still we generally hold persons responsible for their acts, don't we?
Well, we're not saying he shouldn't be held responsible, especially in the mitigation case. I mean, in mitigation, you're choosing life or death. Many times. And if
one particular set of facts caused this person, otherwise normal, to commit these horrendous acts, such as alcohol intoxication did here, and I think it's mitigating that if he spends the rest of his life in prison, he's not likely to get alcohol. It's possible, but he's not likely, and he's not likely to commit these types of offenses again. And I think that there's an awful lot of mitigation. Military service, what? Remorse.
Yeah, I agree with you. What's your view on the opposite of this? The person who, and you've seen the cases, usually a person comes to us, I mean, the person, the defendant, is somebody who doesn't have this kind of a life history. There are persons who have had a very troubled life history, and sometimes they've had virtually no chance in life. They're young when they commit, when they murder someone, and they've come from this cauldron of hate and abuse and mental and physical abuse, and then we execute them. Can you anyway qualify or sort of help us in looking at mitigation in those two lights? One is the sort of model person who makes a mistake, and we say that's mitigation. The other is someone who is so bad, had such a bad life, we say that's mitigation. Is there any consistency in that, do you think, or is that what we should continue to?
Your Honor, there are many types of mitigation, and I think you've taken the two extremes. And what you have to do is look at the kind of particular case, see what those aggravating circumstances of the state's proof, what are those aggravating circumstances. In this particular case, there are two aggravating circumstances, the Illinois police officer and the so-called mass murder specification. And you have to weigh what the appropriate penalty is. And I think you can make the argument both ways depending upon the case. And mitigation is not black and white. This is a pure mitigation case. This is not a guilt, for instance, or not a guilt case. This is a pure mitigation case. And there is a lot of mitigation here. And there can be mitigation, as you suggest, of a different type and a different case. That you can certainly make the argument that death is not appropriate. And that's what the jury's focusing on. Is death appropriate in this particular situation with this particular person and how the case went down? And in this case, death certainly is not appropriate. I thank the court for its time and attention. I ask the court to reverse the death sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.